Well, hello again, my fine feathered friends. I am back. So I've been doing a little research on this case. It was first brought to my attention when I saw the case featured on the Unsolved Mysteries years and years and years ago. This one actually really frightened me, and there was actually a book made. I read the book. It goes a little more in depth, besides what they showed on the Unsolved Mystery segment. But this case always really creeped me out, and it still does, because you don't know, was this all in her imagination? Was she making it up? Was she in cahoots? And the person I'm talking about is Cindy James. So let's go into this, okay. So, in June 1989, in Richmond, near Vancouver, British Columbia, a body was found lying in the yard of an abandoned house. It happened to be the body of 44-year-old Cindy James. She was drugged and strangled. Her hands and feet had been tied behind her back. The police believe that her death was actually either an accident or suicide. Now, that gives you something to think about. When someone is basically hogtied like that and the police officials are trying to say it was suicide or an accident, there's something else going on. And this dives into the story of why the police came to that conclusion. So Cindy had graduated nursing school in 1961. She had later become an admin for a preschool. She was married, but she never had kids. And in July of 1982, her and her husband had separated. 4 months later, this is when the campaign of fear and harassment and just everything began for 7 years. So 4 months after the split, Sydney had begun to receive mysterious and threatening phone calls. Now, during the 7 years, she reported nearly 100 incidences of harassment. 5 of them were actually violent attacks. Things got worse, though, for her after she involved the police. Cindy would be at home, and at night, she would hear her prowlers. Her phone lines were severed several times. She had confided to her friend, Agnes Woodcock, that she began receiving bizarre cut and paste notes that begin to appear on her doorstep, basically threatening notes saying, you know, I'll see you soon, I'll get you, those type of things. She had basically told her friend Agnes that this person was trying to scare her to death, that they didn't want to kill her, they didn't want to harm her, they wanted to basically scare her to death. So soon after, Sydney became more reluctant and was frightened to give any more details. And that caused the police to doubt her story. So if you think about that, if you're being harassed, threatened, you know, almost to a point of where you are so scared that this person really is going to do something, wouldn't you be more willing to give information and share the information if you do in fact have it? So that is why the police began to suspect her story. On January 1983, Agnes, her friend, had dropped by Sydney's house for a visit, knocking on her door, but never receiving an answer. So her friend had assumed that Sydney was taking her nightly bath that she usually did. Agnes went to go investigate around the front of the house, and that's where she came across Sydney's body with a nylon stocking that had been tightly wrapped around her neck. Sydney had said that she had gone out to the garage to get a box, and suddenly someone grabbed her from behind, and she said all she saw were white sneakers. So Sydney, after this incident, had moved to a new house, painted her car, and even changed her last name. She also hired a private investigator, Ozzy Caban. The police continued with their investigation and questioned Sydney several times. And they would later report, or Ozzy, I'm sorry, her private investigator, later did report that she wouldn't tell the entire story. She would be evasive, withhold information. The police even gave her a polygraph test, and the examiner claimed that she was, in fact, withholding information. So that gives you kind of an idea of what is she trying to hide? Is she involved in these attacks and this continued harassment somehow? And if she is, why? Is she going through, you know, split personality? Does she have, you know, schizophrenia, something like that? So, I mean, I kind of give it to the police where you don't know if she's telling the truth. And that is, you know, why they begin to doubt her story and all that. On January 30th, 1984, Ozzy, her private investigator, had heard strange sounds coming over a two-way radio that he had given her. When he got to the house, he found it was locked. He went around trying to find, you know, an unlocked door, a window, anything. He finally looked through the window and found her lying on the floor. He, you know, kicked the door open, broke it down, found her laying on the floor with the knife with a note. And the knife was through her hand, and it pinned the note to the ground. They never said what the note said, but she was taken to the hospital, where she had told police that she recalled being attacked and a needle going into her arm. So if that is true, that does explain why she never actually sees anybody. But no suspects were located. And the police had noted that Sydney sometimes would see one person, sometimes it was two or three. So those stories of inconsistencies, you either believe, yes, this poor lady is being harassed, but is it a group effort? You know, pretty much that's what you're going to assume if they're seeing, you know, sometimes she sees one person, sometimes two, sometimes three. So you got a question. Is it all in her head, or is this all a big conspiracy? Did she know something? You just never know. And in the book, they claim that maybe there was a possibility that she may have known something or may have seen something. We'll dive into that a little bit later. So after that, the threatening phone calls still continued, but they were too short to ever trace. So the police had put 24-hour surveillance on her for days on end. They would do this for, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 days with up to 14 officers on this surveillance. But nothing would happen. But as soon as surveillance was taken off, of course, another incident would occur. But you also got to think, if this person, if she really is being, you know, attacked, if this person is following her and watching her, of course they're going to know that the police are there. You know, they're not going to do anything when they know that she is being watched or there's surveillance on her home. You know, police are not that slick sometimes. So later on December 11th, 1985, Sydney was actually found dazed and semi-conscious laying in a ditch 6 miles from her home. She was wearing a man's work boot and a glove, and she was suffering from hypothermia. Cuts and bruises had covered her body, and a black nylon stocking had been tied tightly around her neck. She claimed she had no memory as of what happened. Now, fast forward to a couple weeks later, Agnes Woodcock, which was her best friend, and her husband Tom had stayed with Cindy one night. When they heard a noise and woke up to find that the basement was in flames and the phone lines had been cut. Tom, Sydney's friend's husband, had ran outside to tell the neighbors to alert them to call, you know, the fire department. And when he went outside, he says that he had saw a man at the curb, and Tom had asked him, you know, call the fire department. As soon as he said this, the man had ran off. The police found no dust or fingerprints on the outside of the window sill, and that suggested to them that the fire was actually set inside the house. So knowing the police suspected her, you know, must have drove her crazy. She was going to her psychologist. They just did not believe her. So Sydney's doctor had actually committed her to a local psychiatric ward. because he believed that she was becoming suicidal because she claimed that she knew who was doing this and they were trying to drive her crazy. They were trying to, so first of all, she said she was scared to death, that these people were trying to scare her to death. Then, she kept telling her psychologist that, this person doesn't want to kill her. They want to drive her crazy. So again, you got to say, which is it? What's going on? But 10 weeks later, she had left the hospital, and her dad, Otto, had said that she had finally admitted that she knew more than she was saying, and she would go after the perpetrator herself. So if she's admitting that, then that makes sense that maybe she did see something. And in the book, one of the suspects was, yes, the ex-husband. He was dealing in some shady, you know, business dealings. So maybe she knew something and maybe saw something, or that's the only thing I can think of. But a campaign of 7 years of harassment and terror, that's a long way. That takes commitment. I mean, I know that sounds harsh to say, but that takes a lot of commitment. 7 years of notes and harassment and attacks. Crazy. So on May 25th, 1989, 6 years, oh, I'm sorry, 6 years, not 7 years, 6 years and 7 months after the first threatening phone call, Sydney had disappeared. On that day, her car was found in a parking lot of a local store. Inside were groceries and a wrapped gift. There was, however, blood on the driver's side door, and items from her wallet were underneath her car. Now, nobody could explain this. Nobody could figure out what had happened. There was no sightings. There was nothing. No records on her ATM, debit, nothing. So 2 weeks later, that's when her body was found at the abandoned house with her hands and feet that were tied behind her back. Yet, the autopsy revealed that she had died of a drug overdose of morphine. Now, the knots that she was tied with, I guess the police had brought in knot specialists. And they recreated those knots in a matter of maybe 2 minutes. So if you believe that she was making this up and she was campaigning against herself of this terror, maybe she wanted attention, or maybe she, you know, had, like I said, split personality. But it makes you think, if she was so drugged up on this morphine, how long would it take for the morphine to actually affect? Could she tie herself up with the knot specialist says it was a matter of 2 or 3 minutes, but, you know, I don't know much about morphine, but as much as, you know, to make you overdose, wouldn't you not be fully aware and just kind of out of it to make these type of knots, even though they were very simple if you're that drugged up? And if she's already tied up, how is she going to take and inject herself with morphine? So that's the real question. What really happened here? You know, the suspects were, of course, like I said, her ex-husband. But there was also another suspect that came to light, which was Pat McBride, who was actually like a, I guess you want to say, lover of Sydney's. But he was also a policeman. So maybe she saw something with him, you know, maybe she knew something about this policeman, and that's when all this happened. But it's very hard to say. It's like, you don't want to blame the victim, because this is a horrible thing. Like, I would be terrified. Like I said, the segment that they had filmed for Unsolved Mysteries, it always terrified me. And then reading the book, you kind of see she wasn't, I mean, in my opinion, I don't think she was crazy. I think someone really was just after her. Maybe, I don't know. It's very hard to wrap my head around because of all these different circumstances. But you know what? Stranger things have happened, you know? Like, something that appears to be one thing, and then you find out with evidence and, you know, confessions or whatever, it's completely different. So That won't always bug me, but if you get a chance to read it, the book is called The Life and Death of Sydney James. It's a really good book. It's really interesting. It delves a lot into, you know, there was a lot more stuff that happened. There was an actual recording because someone had left a message on machine. I found it on YouTube. It's really, really chilling. It really, you hear that. And honestly, that's, I think, what frightened me the most, just that voice. And it's very hard to hear, at least for me, knowing with everything that was going on. It's pretty creepy. So if you get a chance, go ahead, read that book, The Life and Death of Sydney James. And if you can, go on YouTube. I believe the tape recording was on A Current Affair, I believe. I'm not quite sure. You can probably just look up Cindy James, you know, phone recording, and it'll probably pop up. But again, salutations, guys. Or actually, not salutations. Durr. I'm losing it. I hope y'all have a good day. I'm going to enjoy my day off. And until next time, keep it classy.